Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Former President Donald Trump has left the White House, but he's still not allowed back on Twitter. After the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, many of the extremists who committed crimes that day had posted their views, their intentions, and some of their actions on social media platforms. Large social media outlets routinely ban, if mostly temporarily, those who violate their user agreements. Today we're going to talk about the First Amendment and you, and our guest for that conversation is Gene Polosinski. He is a leading national scholar on First Amendment protections and a senior fellow at Freedom Forum, and he has been with us before, so welcome back, Gene. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
I want to ask you a question about the intentions of the First Amendment for the founders. What were they? What do we know about what they were thinking and protecting against when they established the First Amendment?
That's a really good question. The first thing they were protecting against was the government being able to either control our speech or punish it for speech that we've already delivered. So that was their main intent. But the larger goal behind that was to allow us to talk without government interference to arrive, I think, at the best possible solution for the greatest number of people in the shortest amount of time. That's really why we have a First Amendment, to protect free speech.
And as we look at how that's evolved, does it matter that the ways of delivering that speech, we're not talking about, you know, standing on the corner and just shouting or handing out a pamphlet anymore? We add in things like radio and television and the internet and social media. Does that make a difference, or is it really, you know, no change here?
Again, really good question. You know, under the law, there should be no difference in the delivery platform. It's, you know, it's the idea that government can't stop us, block us from our viewpoint, or punish us for the content of our speech. So in that sense, the platform that we use, whether it's the spoken word or, you know, Twitter or Facebook or something, is irrelevant. Now, on a practical way, you have to think about what's your access to what they call the marketplace of ideas. You know, I think the founders presumed you're not just talking out in the forest or out, you know, in a farmland where no one hears you, that you're going to be heard by people when you speak. So there is that practical consideration of exactly how do you get to people in the marketplace. And, you know, I've coined a phrase that I use, that we've moved from the village green to the village screen, because social media is really now taking the place of that village area where we might have all gone in the colonial time to talk. So I think it has implications for it, but legally it is irrelevant in the larger sense.
And throughout this whole time, we've been saying the government cannot block this. But when it comes to your employer or an organization, you know, a platform like Twitter or Facebook, where you have signed a user agreement, that is different in a lot of ways. Tell us how.
Well, the user agreements are essentially a contract. You think of it as, when you sign up to use their service, you say, okay, you set the rules, you have the option to change those rules, and I will abide by them. So that's a contract. So that's really outside of, again, it's not the government, so doesn't apply. So you set up that contract. And then you mentioned your employer. You know, one of the things that I think we were very fond of saying is, you know, I'm an American, I can say what I want. But again, your employer is not the government. Actually, even if it is, you don't have those First Amendment protections against action. It's a little different for a government employee, but let's just say you're working for a private entity. Unless you have a contract guaranteeing that you can speak your mind or wear a sign, you know, a shirt that says something or carry a sign, you're really at the whim of the employer. Again, the First Amendment doesn't protect you. Most states have something called wrongful dismissal statutes that you can sue under if you think you've been fired for the wrong reason. But they really go to things like race, religion, skin color, maybe a few other technical things, but they don't cover that free speech part. When you get to private entities, you're pretty much at the whim of the employer. You know, actually, government employees have less protection than even you and I might. Because if you're a government employee, let's say you run the street department, and you start saying something negative about how the street department is run, you can actually, under some Supreme Court decisions called Garcetti, you can be punished for that because you've harmed the ability of government to perform its functions. So Once you move away from the government actually actively moving to silence you for the content of your speech, you move into unprotected zones. It may sound complicated, but keep that in mind. If it's the government and you don't work for the government, they really can't stop you from speaking and punish you for your speech, which doesn't preclude other ramifications like being fired from your job.
Does that apply to elected officials? That notion of not harming government from performing its function? Because clearly we want them to have robust discussions about where government isn't working and is working. That's a large part of their job. But does that apply to
really? That's a really good point, because we actually want elected officials to talk about their work in public.
Exactly.
So that what they would probably be protected under, if you will, is something that is going to sound like a cop out for the courts. It's called non-justiciable, which means that let's say you're the mayor and you say something that people don't like, that people think harms the ability of your city to perform its duties. The courts tend to say, you know what? That's an elected official. That's settled at the ballot box rather than by a court. So the protection for your speech would really be more in the area of voter approval or disapproval than under a First Amendment area. But again, the technical terms that I've seen used in those cases, and sometimes it comes up during a campaign where people will say stuff, is non-justiciable. I mean, it can't be judged. It's really for the voters to decide.
Right. So I think most people have a basic understanding of, you know, you can't scream fire in a crowded theater, that there is a notion of you cannot incite people to action with your words that is harmful. That has to be a subjective decision, though. Tell us a little bit about when words, everything from hate speech to, you know, words that stir up a crowd, words said in an interview on TV might be interpreted as causing people to act in a violent manner.
Again, you've really put your finger on an issue that is hot today. The key is how imminent and direct was the link between your words and that violent conduct. Again, it's not punishing you for having those views or stopping you from having those views. It is, did you directly incite someone to do something illegally? Again, there has to be what's called direct causality. It has to be a direct link. So let's say that I'm giving a speech and I talk about a certain group of people and I tell they're awful and horrible and, you know, if you see them, you should beat them up and all that. And 5 weeks later, somebody remembers that, they see that person from that group and they beat them up. It's going to be really hard to charge me at that moment with incitement or causing that activity. Now, go to the other end of the spectrum. I finish those remarks, and I look up, and I'm in an auditorium, and I see somebody, and I go, there's one now, go get him. That clearly violates the law and is not protected speech. As you've indicated, the difficulty is how do you move along that spectrum from fully protected to unprotected? And it's going to be a determination by a judge or a jury whether you were so, what they call proximate, was it so directly related? So let's say instead of 5 weeks later, it's 10 minutes later. Let's say that it is 5 minutes later and directly outside the place where you were speaking, maybe an auditorium and you went outside and saw somebody. So I think that's going to be, you might use call it subjective. I think that's really where the fact pattern is up to the government to prove, by the way. You don't go in 50-50. It's not like you have to prove it. The government has to prove that direct, exact link. So when we're talking in this case, if you will, about President Trump and others at the rally, would 35, 40 minutes and walking directly from that rally up to the Capitol, will that constitute that kind of proximate or direct relationship? That's going to be the hurdle that a prosecutor is going to have to prove.
Yeah. Then let's go back to this idea of, you know, Twitter or Facebook banning people. And, you know, even whether it's a temporary, you know, you're in Facebook jail is the joke to a permanent kind of violation. And I think, Gene, of course, one of the big questions here is people saying, you know, is this the role of these companies? And are they making choices that are based on their own political leanings? Or are they making choices based on the kind of culture they want to create, you know, in their online forum? It gets a little muddy here because we really don't know how these companies function. Are they publishers? Are they platforms? Are they news organizations? Unpack that for us a little bit, please.
Sure. Well, whether they're publishers or simple, you know, technical platforms, or publishers more akin to, say, newspapers, radio, TV, your operation. Again, they are ultimately private operations. So whether their motives are something we approve of or not, or hidden or not, they really are their motives. And they have their own First Amendment rights to operate as they will. Now, that's under current law. There are some people who say, you know, they've become so essential to the way we operate that they've become, in effect, a public forum or a place that functions like government. You know, just the government doesn't sponsor Twitter, but these people are as powerful as government. One of the ideas is that I've heard people talk about is that we forget that when electric utilities and water utilities started back in the 1800s, they're certainly privately owned, as many are now. But you just signed a contract. You know, they ran a wire to your house and you got electricity. Well, over time, we said, you know, that is so vital to society, and the way they operate is so important that government has to step in and have a role. So we call them public utility. They're privately owned. They have stockholders. They make their own decisions, but those decisions operate under a framework set up by government. For example, public utilities, if they're really showing, you know, allegiance to their stockholders and you don't pay your bill, they cut off your power. Well, what if it's mid-February in South Dakota and the temperature's below zero? Somebody can die. So we've said, wait a minute, there are some rules here that are going to apply to when you can shut people off and the notice you have to give them and all the rest. So we may move to that kind of structure around the web, and particularly social media, but there's one hurdle for that, which is there are only so many electric companies. We haven't yet seen that as dominant as Twitter and Facebook and some of these things are on the web today. Will they be that way tomorrow? Some people listening may remember something called MySpace. It was kind of an early social media entity you communicated across. Well, somebody invented a better system, which was Facebook and Twitter and all the rest, and MySpace now is kind of just a distant memory. So I think if you want to approach them as making them a public utility or that they're a monopoly, one of the real challenges to getting that through legislation and getting it approved by the courts will be, are they really, or are they just the latest best idea? And that the next time somebody else comes along and offers a way to communicate on the web, and we're seeing this now with some of the conservative sites, will that just, you know, say, well, then there's nothing you can do. You don't like Twitter, go to Gab or go to Parler or one of the, if it's, again, using the examples in front of us today, more conservative sites that aren't stopping people, putting them in Facebook jail for something that the conservatives feel is shutting down their voice. So it gets, you know, it's not a clear-cut circumstance. As a society, we're going to have to make some very tough decisions as the Internet ages, so to speak.
Yeah. What are some of the questions we need to, because what I'm wondering is, you know, if I'm the CEO of Twitter, I'm also going to make the argument that Twitter's already kind of a reputation for being a cesspool, and, you know, I'm struggling to figure out what kind of platform this is anyway. And if I just allow all this stuff, I mean, it's just terrible for my brand. So I need to be able to make some choices. That's, as a private business owner, what I'm going to argue, right? And I don't want the government to come interfere, because I'm responsible to those shareholders. And if everybody, you know, if there's a huge rise of anti-Semitism on my site and I do nothing, I'm accountable to consumers and shareholders, and they will go somewhere else. That's the argument I'll make as a business owner, at least, you know, in some ways, along with other arguments. What are some of the questions we need to be asking as we look at how the world has changed with some of these, you know, village screen kind of companies that are functioning in a new way? Are there foundational questions you want to leave us with here today?
Well, I think so. I think the founders would have said, are you sure you want government in? Because, again, you know, if you violate the terms of service, you go to Facebook jail. If government gets involved and there are penalties, they're probably civil and criminal, and you can go to real jail for violating them. And then also look at the time it takes properly for government to prosecute you, let's say. You know, there was an instance with a disc jockey or a host, radio host named Don Imus a few years ago, who said some things that were racially offensive to the Rutgers women's basketball team. The FCC stepped in, the power of government, because he was using public airways. It took something like 10 years to arrive at a final decision on that. In the meantime, what I call the court of public opinion moved within weeks. advertisers said, we don't want to be associated with this. Readers complain or listeners complain. He was off the air for a time. He got the message. So again, do we really want that power and necessary step by step of government to step in here? It sounds like a nice idea. Let's just tell government to say First Amendment's going to apply. But there's a lot of things we need to ask ourselves about that when we take what appears to be an easy route, because I fear it won't be.
Gene Policinski is a senior fellow at Freedom Forum and a national scholar on the First Amendment. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Gene. You are welcome back anytime. I suspect we'll have plenty of questions in the days ahead as well. Thank you for today.
Oh, it's my pleasure anytime, please. Thank you.